Hi class, it's your professor, Dr. Fields, with another new lecture. This lecture is going to be on neurocognitive disorders and mental disorders due to medical conditions and substances. We haven't talked about the latter yet in respect to the different categories of disorders that we've went over, and I just felt like this lecture was a perfect opportunity to talk about different kinds of psychological disorders being due to medical conditions and/or substances. Okay? So if you go on to slide two after the title slide, in our lecture on somatic-related and physical disorders, if you remember that lecture, we discussed how psychological factors can cause physical symptoms or disorders, or worsen them, exacerbate them, right? So the direction then was psychological symptoms either leading to or worsening physical symptoms, okay, having a physical consequence or impact. Now we are going to discuss how medical conditions and substances, physical factors essentially, can cause psychological symptoms. Okay, so it's the opposite now. Now we're going to talk about different kinds of diseases and medical conditions or substances that you might ingest and how they could cause psychological symptoms. Okay? All right, moving on to slide three, I have four brief videos up, just like almost like a little montage. To give you a flavor, if you will, of the different kinds of symptoms that people experience with these disorders. So as always, take a look at them first, and then you can resume with the lecture. Okay, so assuming that you've watched those videos, we're going to now talk about the neurocognitive disorders. So the first one we're going to discuss is on slide four, and that is delirium. And then after that, which is basically a cluster of symptoms, more a cluster of symptoms than anything else. And then we're going to talk about together, collectively, both mild and major neurocognitive disorder, because there are just some subtle nuances between the two disorders. And in a large sense, they're just, stages of the same kind of thing. So essentially, there are really two disorders that we're talking about here in this lecture. Okay? All right. Delirium. Let's take a look at the criteria for that. This is a disturbance in attention. So that has to do with a reduced ability to direct, focus, sustain, or shift attention, and awareness. So that means a reduced orientation to the environment or disorientation. And that usually looks like confusion. Okay, so that's basically what that means. There's a confusion that the patient goes through, not so aware of where they are or their environment. That's a main feature of delirium. The disturbance develops over a short period of time, usually hours to a few days, and represents, and I will add this word, a substantial change from baseline attention and awareness, and tends to fluctuate in severity during the course of a day. Baseline is normal. That's what baseline means. So how you're normally functioning. This represents a stark change in how you're normally functioning. An additional disturbance also will be present in cognition in either the form of a memory deficit, disorientation, not knowing exactly where you are or, being lost, so to speak, language, visual spatial ability that has to do with, understanding how objects are oriented in our visual field, or perception. And perception involves the senses. So you're talking about tactile, sense of touch. There could be some abnormal tactile perception. Definitely with your vision, you could have some blurry or distorted vision. Or auditory, again, some difficulties with hearing. It could be like a tinnitus, like a ringing in the ears, that kind of thing, but just some disturbed perception, okay? The disturbance in criteria A and C are not better explained by another pre-existing, established, or evolving neurocognitive disorder and do not occur in the context of a severity reduced level of arousal, such as in a coma. There is evidence from the history, physical examination, or laboratory findings that the disturbance is a direct physiological consequence of another medical condition or substance intoxication or withdrawal from a substance. So, a substance being either a drug of abuse or a medication. And it can also be due to exposure to a toxin or due to multiple etiologies. One caveat here, for any of you who did or who know people who did experimented with some over-the-counter medications, particularly like NyQuil, and it was used to party with, and you misused it in the sense that you weren't taking it because you were sick and get to go to sleep, but you were taking it recreationally and using it as a party drug. Young kids or teenagers sometimes do these silly things. You may have experienced a delirium, or the person that you know who abused this may have experienced a delirium, because that is a common side effect of abusing that kind of medication. So, don't do that because delirium is not a fun experience at all. You'll feel completely spaced out and whacked out, and very similar to like what we talked about with depersonalization, derealization disorder. It will be an intense experience like that, but it also presents with these kind of cognitive and perceptual deficits as well. So it's not a fun experience. So if you know anyone who's thinking about doing that, make sure you inform them and educate them. Don't do that. Okay, we have a bunch of specifiers here. So, depending on how the delirium was caused, either by substance intoxication, right, or by a substance use disorder, right, or from medication or a medical condition, that's basically going to be listed. Why did this happen? It almost always is a result of a medical condition or a substance or a toxin or something of that nature. It's usually not, psychologically induced, like depersonalization, derealization. Okay? Okay. And there's just a few more specifiers down there. Hold on one sec. I'm sorry. I just bopped out of here. Okay. Oh, so, and then there's some specifiers that also have to do with how the duration of it. Acute, lasting a few hours or days, and then persistent, lasting weeks or months. And usually, if it's persistent, it's because the person hasn't figured out that it's due to some medication they're on, or some drugs they're taking, or an underlying medical condition has not been realized or properly treated. Okay, and then there's hyperactive. The individual has a hyperactive level of psychomotor activity. They're agitated, they're very antsy, very fidgety, or hypoactive, which is the opposite, which is sluggishness, lethargy, slow moving, this experience feeling, as if you're moving through jello. Okay? All right. Moving on. I combine these two. Okay, now let me say a few things about this next slide here, number five, mild major neurocognitive disorder. There's a separate list of criteria for mild and a separate list of major, and they're almost identical except for a few words. And so rather than, you know, just reiterating the same criteria for the most part, I just put in here a couple, you know, term switches that I'll point out to you here that really differentiate mild from major neurocognitive disorder. Because other than those few key terms, they're essentially the same. Okay? So let's look at these criteria here, and I'll point that out to you. And also in the book, they list, you know, the criteria for each and every different kind of medical disease. You know, there's neurocognitive disorder due to HIV, neurocognitive disorder due to Parkinson's, due to this, due to that. And again, they're essentially, you know, all coming from these main criteria. So I don't expect you to know the different nuances between each kind of medical condition's version of neurocognitive disorder, because they all have this in common. And these are the main major criteria here. These are the ones I want you to focus on. So don't focus on, I think there's like 10 different criteria sets in the book. You don't need to focus on all of them. I just want you to know the major ones. Delirium and mild and major neurocognitive disorder. Okay? We will talk about briefly the different diseases, and you should have some basic knowledge of those diseases, which we're going to get into. Okay, so let's look at these criteria. Evidence of a modest slash significant. Whenever you see this slash, I added that. That is going to correspond to whether it's a mild or major neurocognitive disorder, right? So evidence of a modest cognitive decline would be for a mild neurocognitive disorder. Evidence of a significant cognitive decline is for a major neurocognitive disorder, okay? So evidence of either a modest or significant cognitive decline. Cognitive has to do with thinking, right? Intelligence, thinking, all that kind of stuff. From a previous level of performance in one or more cognitive domains. So it can affect complex attention processes, you know, that could be involved in tasks that require a high level of attention, such as reading or writing, or, you know, paying bills, you know, focusing on numbers and that kind of stuff. Executive functioning, which is very related to attention. Executive function has to do with planning and organizing and directing your behavior, okay? Learning and memory, language, perceptual motor, which also is termed sensory motor. That means basically primarily talking about motor control of your hands, right? And so our hands are directed by our senses, either our eyesight or what we hear. They're used as an instrument of ours to explore our environment. So any deficit such as that. So in other words, like with a task of writing, you know, they may have all of a sudden grave difficulties with writing, where they're writing off the page and they're not able to direct their hand movements with their vision, something of that nature, okay? Or social cognition. Basically, social cognition has to do with social ability, you know, like understanding sarcasm or understanding the nonverbal aspects of somebody's language, not picking up on different gestures or different intonations, not really understanding what's going on in a social situation. Almost very similar to what a person with autism spectrum disorder would go through. But the difference is that someone with autism spectrum disorder was born that way. This person was functioning fine, and then all of a sudden, they acquire this neurocognitive disorder, and these abilities that once were fine for them, they didn't have any issues with any of these abilities, now are compromised. Okay? Okay. So this is going to be based on, in terms of how do we assess that they have these deficits, either the individual is reporting it, the patient, a knowledgeable informant, like maybe the patient's spouse or grandson or some other important caregiver, or the clinician has concluded this, okay? And that, this represents either a mild, if it's mild neurocognitive disorder, or a significant decline in cognitive function, which would be major neurocognitive disorder, okay? And also a modest or substantial impairment, depending on mild or major, in cognitive performance that is documented by standardized neuropsychological testing, or if you don't have that, another qualified type of assessment. So basically, we want numbers here. We want, some kind of way of measuring so that it's not just subjective, so that we can say, yes, there is a deficit in their attention, or there is a deficit in their learning or memory, or perceptual motor skills. We have tests for all of those things in psychology. So we want to test it to make sure. And then the cognitive deficits do not, if it's mild, or do, if it's major, interfere with independence in everyday activities. At a minimum, they require assistance with complex instrumental activities of daily living, such as paying bills, managing medications, etc., etc. In major neurocognitive disorder, they need assistance. Mild, they don't, at least not yet. Okay? The cognitive deficits do not occur exclusively in the context of a delirium, and the cognitive deficits are not better explained by another mental disorder, such as major depressive disorder or schizophrenia. What they will be explained by is a medical condition. And so here is a list of the very common medical conditions that can cause mild or major neurocognitive disorder. We have Alzheimer's disease, frontotemporal lobar degeneration, Lewy body disease, vascular disease, traumatic brain injury, substance or medication use, which is causing it, HIV infection, prion disease, Parkinson's, Huntington's, etc., etc. Okay? Note, in some cases, there is a need for an additional recording for the etiological medical condition. That's etiological, if you remember, means cause. So there could be a need for an additional recording of the medical condition that's causing it, which would be one of these specifiers here. And that is what the book lists with all the different criteria sets for the different diseases. Again, not necessary to know that. Okay. Some other specifiers here. Now, these specifiers here are really more for major neurocognitive disorder. It's either going to be with or without behavioral disturbance. Okay? So sometimes they can also present with a behavioral disturbance, which could have also associated symptoms in terms of psychomotor symptoms, in terms of, just like with delirium, being very fidgety or agitated, mood disturbance. They often suffer from depression because they realize on some level that something's not right with them, or that they've lost their ability, especially if it's, a mild neurocognitive disorder. They're definitely aware that they've lost their ability. But even in major neurocognitive disorder, many people in with Alzheimer's disease who are in the more progressive stages of the illness know that something's not right with them. Okay? All right. So that is pretty much it in terms of the criteria sets that you should know. So let's talk about this group of disorders collectively. I'm now on slide 6. So you'll remember this category sounds very similar to neurodevelopmental, right? Disorders, right? Neurocognitive, neurodevelopmental. Whenever we're talking about neuro, we're talking about the brain. So just like neurodevelopmental disorders are presumed, and there's a lot of evidence for this, to be basically brain-based psychological conditions, so are neurocognitive disorders. Okay? So, neurodevelopmental disorders almost always occur in childhood, but these disorders, neurocognitive disorders, these kinds of brain disorders usually occur in late adulthood. They can occur earlier in life with the advent of certain diseases and from traumatic brain injuries, such as from an accident, like in an automobile accident, or from substances at any age. Going back to what I was talking about with abusing NyQuil. Okay, so I want to now make a distinction here between delirium and mild and major neurocognitive disorder, which I'm kind of lumping together. So delirium is a temporary cognitive impairment with a sudden and intense or acute. Acute means sudden and intense. In other words, it comes on very suddenly. Somebody downs a whole bottle of NyQuil, right? And then, all of a sudden, has all these kinds of disoriented, confused, and inattentive symptoms, that come on very suddenly. That's a delirium. It happens, very quickly. It doesn't gradually come on, it comes on all of a sudden, okay? And it could occur from other kinds of drugs, it's not so uncommon to experience a delirium from doing too much MDMA, which is ecstasy. You could also experience a delirium. And when I'm talking about this, I'm not just talking about while under the influence of the drug. A lot of times the delirium can happen afterwards. Okay, so or after the high, so to speak, right? But this can occur with many different kinds of substances of abuse, and it can also occur with certain kinds of medications, certain psychotropic medications for people who are very sensitive to certain kinds of drugs may experience a delirium. Okay, and it's like I said, it's technically, we're calling it a disorder, but it's more of a cluster of symptoms that occurs in response to a substance or a toxin or a medical condition. Certain medical conditions can lead to a delirium happening all of a sudden. So it's this all of a sudden intense experience that eventually goes away. Okay? Compare that with a mild or major neurocognitive disorder, which is a progressive cognitive impairment. So this is often a mild case that gradually gets worse over time and can often become a major case. So a lot of times, when we're looking at mild major neurocognitive disorders, what we're looking at are two stages of the same thing. Okay, so that if mild neurocognitive disorder progresses to a certain point, it can then eventually become major neurocognitive disorder. Okay? Major neurocognitive disorder used to be called dementia. So if any of you remember or recall that term or you heard that before, that's what it used to be called. We used to say, that these symptoms are dementia, major neurocognitive disorder. Okay, mild neurocognitive disorder was a term that was included in the DSM-5 to basically acknowledge that there is a less severe stage of this progression. And because it's so important nowadays for early detection, especially of like diseases like Alzheimer's, it was very important to emphasize that, we need as clinicians to be very aware of any kind of early signs, even if they don't meet full criteria for dementia. So that's why that was included. Okay. What this basically is it is a progressive, gradual cognitive impairment occurring over time that includes growing deficits in memory, including agnosia, which is a term that means difficulty recognizing or naming objects, and could also include facial agnosia, where you have a difficult time recognizing faces. A lot of times, people with dementia, or major neurocognitive disorder, a lot of times will, their family members will visit them and they won't know who they are because they don't recognize their faces. They don't recognize the face of their own wife or son or et cetera, et cetera. Also involves growing deficits in thinking, sensory motor skills, attention, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all these different kinds of intellectual cognitive functions become more and more impaired over time. Like delirium, oh, I'm sorry. These like deliriums are more common in older adults and usually almost always due to a medical condition or a substance. But in contrast to deliriums, they are conditions or entities unto themselves. They are often two different stages, so to speak, of dementia. I'm talking about mild or major neurocognitive disorder. Okay? So, delirium is more of like, almost look at this like a side effect, right? It's almost like the side effect of a different kind of disease or medication or substance or withdrawal from the substance, that happens, this cluster of symptoms, where this is more of like a progressive mental illness. Okay? All right, going on to slide number 7, we'll talk about some prevalence rates. For Alzheimer's disease, it's estimated that 5 million people in the United States suffer from that. That is a lot of people. It is the most common cause of neurocognitive disorder, and there is a slightly higher rate for females than males. Okay? And Alzheimer's disease always leads to neurocognitive disorder. I mean, it's essentially a neurocognitive disorder because that is the main features of that illness. And then we have Parkinson's disease neurocognitive disorder. Parkinson's disease, a worldwide estimate, is between 0.1 to 0.3% of the population, okay? And 75% of those who survive for 10 years or more will develop Parkinson's disease neurocognitive disorder. So not everyone with Parkinson's disease will develop a neurocognitive disorder, but the large majority will. Then there is vascular neurocognitive disorder. Vascular means has to do with blood vessels. So think of like blood vessels being blocked, as in a stroke. Okay, this disorder occurs in 1.5% of individuals aged 70 to 75, and then it goes up tenfold by time people reach the age of 80. Afflicting 15% of people aged 80 or older. And this has a slightly higher rate for males. Huntington's disease neurocognitive disorder, the research is very sparse for this, meaning we don't have a lot of research that's based off of, that gives us any good estimates, or I should say there's a lack of good research studies to really say what the estimated rate is. So that's why you see that large variability there. It's anywhere between 20 to 80%. So it doesn't really tell us much when you have that kind of variability in the research studies. The most important thing to know here is that Huntington's disease is also a common culprit of neurocognitive disorder. Okay? Then there's HIV neurocognitive disorder. This only happens to less than 10% of HIV infected people. And the reason why is because they've made such strides with HIV medication, that the HIV medication that is available nowadays is extremely effective for keeping the HIV symptoms at bay. And so therefore, not many people with HIV are going to develop neurocognitive disorder because of the improvements in medications for HIV. And then I wanted to give you one prevalence rate for a substance use disorder. For alcohol-related neurocognitive disorder, right? The most common neurocognitive disorder out of all the different substances, because alcohol is the most commonly abused out of the psychoactive drugs, right? If we're not, talking about caffeine and nicotine, except for that. 7% of people with alcohol use disorder will develop alcohol-related neurocognitive disorder, okay? So you're talking about people with very severe chronic alcohol use disorder, right? Usually you're talking about people who are drinking daily, and large amounts and quantities over many, many years that will develop this. So it can be caused by a variety of different medical conditions or substance use, or toxins, right? But the symptoms are all very similar. Okay, going on to slide 8. So, for neurocognitive disorders, the causes are really biological. I mean, that's what we're really talking about here. We're talking about, in terms of the direct causes, they're biological. They're biological in the sense that they're due to either a medical condition or some kind of substance. Okay? So, what is Alzheimer's disease? That commonly that is the most common cause of neurocognitive disorder. Well, that is a disease that is characterized by multiple cognitive deficits, including impaired memory, learning, language. Impaired language is called aphasia, orientation, judgment, reasoning, and also presents with these other symptoms, such as restricted interest, withdrawal, negative affect, that means, mostly like a depressed kind of mood, and outbursts. They frequently can become very angry and volatile, and probably because they're frustrated. They know that their cognitive functioning is declining, and it's frustrating when, when you used to be able to read or write very easily, or, recall names or recall facts very easily, be able to do basic tasks and chores like paying bills and, housekeeping kinds of tasks. And then all of a sudden, your ability to do these things is very compromised. Or I shouldn't say all of a sudden, eventually your ability to do these things becomes more and more compromised over time. That can be very frustrating, okay? Vascular disease is another typical cause of neurocognitive disorder, and that has to do, like we said before, with restricted or blocked blood vessels in the case of a stroke. Traumatic brain injury. Now, this could cause a neurocognitive disorder at any age. This could be due to as early as birth, in terms of some kind of severe birth complications, any kind of accident that causes head injury, and then what's been thrown around a lot in the news, it's a hot topic, is kids developing chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is coined CTE, from contact sports. And this has basically been shown on autopsies to be evident in a lot of people that have engaged in some heavy-duty contact sports like football or boxing or those kind of fighting sports. And that this can actually cause a neurocognitive disorder, okay? They can also be caused from what's called Lewy body disease. This is where there are protein deposits in the brain that lead to brain damage over time. This is a certain kind of disease that causes that. Or Parkinson's disease, which is a progressive disease that damages dopamine pathways and leads to deterioration of motor skills. And then, of course, there will be deterioration in cognitive performance as well if they also go on to develop Parkinson's disease with a neurocognitive disorder. Huntington's disease also affects motoric functioning, but this is a genetic disorder, okay? In other words, you inherit this. And then HIV can also be the cause of a neurocognitive disorder, okay? And of course, that's the acquired immunodeficiency virus that causes AIDS. Okay, psychoactive substances, certain heavy-duty ones like MDMA, better known as ecstasy, or certain strong inhalants can lead to a delirium, which is this more temporary kind of neurocognitive type of disorder, right, that we talked about before. Or with repeated use and misuse, chronic use of different kinds of psychoactive substances, it could eventually lead to either mild or major neurocognitive disorder. Okay? So misuse in the short term can cause deliriums, and long term, either mild or major neurocognitive disorder. Okay, now I do talk about in slide 9 some psychological factors, and I put causes here in keeping with the general outline of the course. Psychological factors can also be important, but in an indirect way. So they're not directly causing these neurocognitive conditions, but indirectly they can influence them or lead to them. And I'll tell you how. Very similar to when we had our discussion about, physical disorders, right? In a very similar way, for that. So, there is a lack of evidence for any direct influence of psychological factors. Like we've been talking about, these kind of neurocognitive conditions are almost always caused by a medical condition or disease, or some kind of substance, right? However, as we discovered in our lecture on psychological factors affecting medical conditions or physical disorders, stress and negative emotions can exacerbate or worsen and possibly speed up the progression of mental deterioration in people with neurocognitive disorders. So, in other words, if on top of their neurocognitive disorder, they also are experiencing a lot of stress and negative feelings, right, that can worsen their cognitive functioning, okay, and could actually lead to the progression, or the speeding up of this kind of neurocognitive condition. Also, one's behavior, or more specifically, lifestyle choices, such as them choosing to engage in contact sports or them neglecting their physical health, can potentially lead to the development of a medical disease or condition, right? Contact sports, you could lead to CTE. Not that it happens in the majority of individuals, but it's possible that it could lead to CTE. Or, poor health choices could lead to a stroke. Unsafe sex, which is another behavioral choice, could lead to contracting HIV. And then, of course, that in turn could then eventually lead to the development of a neurocognitive disorder. So indirectly, psychological factors can have an influence, but they definitely don't cause neurocognitive disorder. In terms of looking at developmental factors, well, just like we said for neurodevelopmental disorders, these disorders tend to happen at a certain developmental stage, which is in older age. So being of an older age seems to make someone more susceptible to developing a neurocognitive disorder, such as Alzheimer's, but it is unclear as to why. There's still a lot of unanswered questions with that. Also, the older you are, the more damage an underlying disease or substance use problem can cause. So that's like kind of the simplest reason as to why somebody who is older would be more vulnerable to getting a neurocognitive disorder. The older you are, the longer you may have had some kind of underlying disease, and the longer you have this disease, the more it progresses and eventually starts to lead to a deterioration of your cognitive functioning. Or the older you are, the longer you've had a substance abuse problem for, right? And that eventually can lead to developing a neurocognitive disorder. But in terms of getting Alzheimer's, which is the most common one, we're not sure why yet it affects people, of old age, the elderly. Okay, going on to slide 10. What can we do about these conditions? Well, if we're looking at medical treatment options, at present, there are no drugs that can stop the progression of most neurocognitive disorders, except that which is due to HIV. HIV medication seems to do a really good job at stalling that illness and making sure that it doesn't progress and really start affecting the person's health. And this has changed dramatically over the years. This certainly was not the case when it first came about in the 80s, and certainly not even the case in the 90s. It took a while for the medication to get as effective as it is, but having HIV, as you know, is no longer a death sentence, that people can live a long, long life with HIV and not have it affect them in terms of, any serious physical effects or mental effects like we're talking about. But outside of HIV, they have tried all sorts of drugs to target, let's say, Alzheimer's disease and some of the other diseases like Huntington's and Parkinson's. And the drugs have been found to be somewhat effective in slowing the rate of progression of these diseases and their corresponding neurocognitive disorders. But slowing the rate of progression is very different from stopping the rate of progression. So although they may slow the rate of progression, there's still going to be a gradual decline in their cognitive ability. And then, of course, certainly one could use antidepressants to alleviate any associated negative emotional symptoms. That certainly has been used to help people with Alzheimer's disease who have depression on top of their neurocognitive disorder and anxiety and what have you, okay? Now, while psychological factors don't directly cause these disorders, psychological interventions can definitely be helpful. So, first and foremost, if the neurocognitive disorder is due to substances, like in an addiction, then definitely psychological interventions can be very directly helpful, because if we treat the addiction, and which eventually leads to them being fully abstinent or quitting the drug, right? That can certainly stall and stop basically the progression and even reverse some of the cognitive deficits, at least to some degree. So when you're talking about substance use related neurocognitive disorders, it's simple. In a sense, right? I mean, it sounds very simple, at least, right? Get them to stop misusing this substance or drug, and you will stop the progression of this neurocognitive disorder in most cases. And the longer and longer that they're sober or abstinent for, research has actually shown that that can actually lead to a reversal of symptoms. But this is only true for substance-related neurocognitive disorders, not for the other kind that are due to diseases such as Alzheimer's disease or vascular disease or what have you. Okay? All right. Also, cognitive behavior therapy that includes teaching them compensatory strategies. Like, in other words, can we teach them mnemonic devices to help them remember things? Just like, very similar to what we would do with a student with, any kind of cognitive disability that we were talking about with neurodevelopmental disorders. If you're talking about an autistic child, you're talking about a student with a learning disability or a child with an intellectual disability, you're teaching them compensatory strategies, to compensate for their learning difficulties. And we can do the same thing for people that have a neurocognitive disorder. We could also, what's been very hot in terms of the cognitive behavioral approach for these disorders, is what's called cognitive stimulation. And these are these different kinds of mental games that they can play in a computer to really stimulate and strengthen their cognitive ability, to keep them as sharp as they can, for lack of a better way of saying it. And then behavioral management techniques can be part of the package for caregivers because, and I don't want to liken them to children, but certainly in the very advanced stages of some of these neurocognitive disorders, people with these kinds of conditions can act out. They can be very angry, they're very frustrated, and they can act childlike. And so sometimes a key technique here is to teach whoever's caring for them, whether it be a nurse or a family member or what have you, different kinds of behavioral management techniques so that these behaviors can kind of be kept in check, right? We don't want them to be making the caregiver's life hell. Environmental manipulation, that's also, par for the course whenever we're talking about cognitive behavioral interventions. That has to do with, making their environment so that it's easier to navigate, putting things in spots that's going to be easier for them to remember where they're located, those kind of little tricks to just make life easier for them so that it's less complicated. We can also teach them more effective social communication skills if they've started to have some language impairment or some social communication impairments. And we can also teach certain social communication skills for the caregiver in order to more effectively deal with this individual who's got this degenerative kind of disorder. Psychoeducation has to do with informing them about the disorder and educating them about it, and then just general supportive counseling techniques, that any counseling approach can provide, which, listen, they're going through a life-altering, major life-changing kind of ailment, and they really could use all the help they can get in terms of feeling understood and supported. Okay? All right, so that is basically it for the lecture on neurocognitive disorders. I now want to turn to slide 11, it's just one slide, and talk about something we haven't talked about that is related to all of the different categories of disorders that we've discussed so far. So, in many categories of disorders that we've already talked about, the depressive disorders, the bipolar-related disorders, the obsessive-compulsive-related disorders, the anxiety disorders, the sleep disorders, the sexual disorders, at the end of each of these categories, there are two diagnoses. One for a psychological disorder resulting from a medical condition, and one from a psychological disorder resulting from a substance. So, if you recall, all of the criteria for these psychological conditions, whether it be depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, what have you, basically have a rule out, right? That say, it can't be due to a medical condition. It can't be due to a substance. It can't be due to some other reason, like another mental disorder, right? They have these rule outs. Well, sometimes these conditions are due to a medical condition or a substance, and for that, there is a special way of denoting that. So essentially, the name of the condition will be something like, if it's due to a medical condition, whatever the disorder category name is due to a medical condition. So, example, anxiety disorder due to a medical condition, depressive disorder due to a medical condition, okay? And if it's due to a substance, such as a drug or medication, then it will be coined substance or medication-induced, and then the name of the disorder. So substance-induced sexual dysfunction, substance-induced anxiety disorder, Okay, so I thought this was a good place to talk about that because we're essentially talking about physical disorders or medical conditions that cause psychological problems. So this is, where again, a biological factor, a medical condition, or a substance or drug is causing the psychological condition. Now, does this mean that anybody with a certain medical condition is automatically going to have an anxiety disorder? Does this mean that anybody who has some kind of substance use disorder or who imbibes with substances from time to time is automatically going to have a sexual dysfunction? No. No, it does not. What kinds of people develop anxiety disorders from certain medical conditions, let's say, or other kinds of psychological disorders from certain medical conditions? What kinds of people develop certain kinds of psychological disorders from substances, right? Usually people that are, quote, like vulnerable, right? So it's like, just like we've talked about with all these different kinds of disorders, that there always tends to be this kind of vulnerability, whether it be a biological or psychological vulnerability. People that have a vulnerability are more likely to develop these kinds of psychological disorders, right? People with this kind of psychological vulnerability are more likely to develop these kinds of psychological disorders. So this, the same thing holds true for this as well. If you have a certain kind of psychological or biological vulnerability to developing a disorder, and you are, misusing substances or chronically using substances or have a serious medical condition, you would be more apt to develop a different kind of psychological condition due to the medical condition or substance. Okay? So the treatment for these kinds of conditions is very similar for the treatments of the other kinds of disorders in terms of an anxiety disorder that's psychologically based or an anxiety disorder that's due to a medical condition is going to be treated the same way. Except that when it's due to a medical condition or a substance, we deal with this in a stepwise fashion whereby the medical condition or substance issue is primarily addressed. That's addressed first. If we know that your anxiety is being caused in large part to an underlying medical condition or a substance, for example, then we're going to first, address the medical condition or substance causing that anxiety, right? So, a medical professional like a physician is going to address that first. And then, if you're still experiencing some remnants of that disorder, you still have some anxiety left, it hasn't gone away totally, then we're going to use psychological interventions like we would with any anxiety disorder. Okay, so I just thought that would be important. It was a good place to bring that up here, that sometimes these different kinds of psychological disorders can be due to a medical condition or a substance in large part. All right, okay, so this lecture was a tad bit shorter than usual. I usually go for a good hour, but the lecture prior to this, what on dissociative disorders was a little bit longer with that lengthy video, so it all balances out. All right, stay tuned for the next lecture.